Stories of success in the face of adversity.
In the face of adversity.
Against all odds.
On BFBS, the Forces Station.
Hi, I'm Richard Hatch, and this is Against All Odds. Stories of success in the face of adversity. Our guest on this episode is Mark Billy Billingham, MBE.
And I just thought, there's something about this unit that appeals to me. Just rough and raw and ready, and I thought, that's me.
Paratrooper and 20-year SAS veteran.
So you have your own little way of processing before you go out that night, because the truth is, you generally don't know if you're going to come back.
Hollywood bodyguard.
Tom goes, Billy, meet my girlfriend Penelope.
So that was Penelope...
Penelope Cruz.
Penelope Cruz. And star of SAS Who Dares Wins.
Every single person that comes on that show have come for one reason, to find out who they are.
Coming up, Billy's remarkable stories of defiance and courage and the music that's helped him through challenging times. Starting with his first choice, a track from his youth, this is The Clash and Bank Robber.
Against All Odds with Mark Billy Billingham.
That was The Clash and Bank Robber. I'm with SAS legend Mark Billy Billingham, MBE, and this is Against All Odds, which is a new series on BFBS Radio where we celebrate men and women with a forces connection who've shown incredible strength of character and resilience in their life. Now, Billy, you're known to millions, of course, as the shouty, angry guy on the hit TV show SES Who Dares Wins, where you're the chief instructor. But before that, of course, you had a glittering military career. You served 8 years in the Parachute Regiment and over 20 in the SAS, where you received the Queen's Commendation for Bravery and an MBE. And you've also been a celebrity bodyguard for Tom Cruise and Brad Pitt. There's a lot there. Thanks for coming in.
It's an absolute pleasure, mate. You know, I've got a lot of time and great memories of being with BFBS. One of the sort of comforts of joining a battalion, being away from home for the first time, BFBS was that comfort blanket.
That's so nice to hear. I tell you what is freaking me out a little bit is seeing you smile, which is a little bit unsettling.
That's unfair.
I just start not used to it. I mean, are you a big smiler at home? Would your family say you're a big smiler?
I am, mate. And you know, you got to remember on the show as well, they only cut what they want to cut. I
sure.
am firm and fair. I'm, you know, I've got a sense of humour. A little
okay.
bit, anyway.
So you've got six kids. I'm interested. Yeah. If you said empty the dishwasher to your six kids, would they form a queue, or have you lost all control? Would they listen to you?
Mate, I have more control on SES Who Dares Wins than I do with the kids, that's for sure.
Your first track was The Clash, Bank Robber. Why did you choose that song?
It just takes me back to my troubled days, which is fair to say there were troubled days, and self-inflicted, of course.
You were a tough kid, though. I mean, you were fighting the world, it sounds like.
Yeah, I thought it was a tough kid. I wasn't a tough kid. I was stupid. You know, it all started because of where I grew up. You know, there was gangs everywhere. And I used to look at the older guys with the tattoos, you know, the little marks under the face and all yeah. that. And they'd been in and out of Borstal. But they had a name. And I thought, I want to be one of them. I thought that was the right thing to be. So I was trying to replicate the wrong thing. And, yeah, I was fighting from the age of 9.
Was there a lot of music playing in your house growing up?
Yeah, it was all rock and roll music. Elvis and,
brilliant.
You know, the 50s, 60s, Bill Haley's. And my mum and dad loved that era. And at the time, we didn't like it, but yeah. now...
You love it.
Absolutely love it.
Yeah. Were you happy as a kid?
Absolutely. It was a great family. You know, I didn't realise till after my dad's death when I had to sit down and write his eulogy about who was he, what really was he? Because I just remember him not being there when I was boxing, not there when I was football, but then realised the reason he wasn't, he was working 12-hour shifts. Virtually all his life.
Yeah. You also nearly died in one fight, didn't you? Can you tell us the story and the song that reminds you of it?
It was the latter part. I was about 15 years old. We'd been in and out of these gang fights and it was getting crazy. It was getting out of control. And then one particular day, I ended up in a disagreement with twin brothers. And I went out to meet them, sorted out a fight, basically. And we lived on a railway embankment. And I went over there to meet them, the two of them. There was one sort of stood in front of me, one stood behind me. And I knew it was going to go off. So the guy in front of me, I pushed him. And as he slid down the embankment, I held onto him and I started to kick him in the face.
Yeah.
And then I just felt from behind me, it felt like somebody hit me with a block of wood. It was like a real hard thump in the back. And then my breath was taken away. And these two then just legged it. So I'm now just one. Felt he just kicked me or punched me in the back, and I just felt the pain. It was really, you know, when you play football, you get kicked between the legs. It's that.
Yeah, yeah,
I
yeah.
Can't
yeah.
breathe. I was like that for a second, and then I put my hand around my back, and I just felt blood. This blood running, literally running through my fingers. So I turned towards my house, and as I was going towards my house, I was starting to go all sort of dizzy. And I ended up on my knees, and I'm crawling, still in pain. And as I crawl through the fence, look, I can see my back door right now to the house. Just before I got to the back door, we had an outside toilet. I was just by it, sort of that area there, and it felt great. I was like floating. It was weird. It was basically
you're dying.
I was bleeding to death. Yeah. I didn't know that. And I pushed the door open, and my mum was there mopping the floor, and I can see her right now. And she just turned, and I just heard this almighty scream. And she ran and got this. This was a weird. This woke me up. It was like a mohair jumper. So you got this airy jumper and stuck it straight on the open wound. And I think that was the last I remember. The memories that take me back to that was the song by Elvis called Don't. I just remember my dad singing it. And the weird thing about it was, while I'm lying there thinking, I'll never hear that song again. And it was the one that reminded me of that horrendous day. I think when I came out of that part, I was still in a bad way, and I said, I'm not a religious person at all. I think I did pray then and said, if I get out of this, please, let me get through this. I'm going to change my life. I'm going to, you know, do the right thing. And to a degree, that's what I did.
A wake-up call.
It was a real wake-up call, yeah.
Before we talk about why you joined the military in your next song, will you just tell us about being a celebrity bodyguard for Tom Cruise? What was Tom Cruise like when you met him?
You know what? Like everybody, if you're about to do something, particularly if you're going to work in like an industry like this, you want to know who your client is. So I heard all the rumors. He's small. He's really tiny. He's got a real attitude. He's got this weird belief. He's a bit... Anyway... I ended up flying out to meet him in Rome for the first time. Never met him before, of course. So I turn up there, do all the recce, do all that sort of stuff, and then go and meet him. And he flies into a private airport, walks off the plane. Straight away, he came straight to me. Now, whether somebody had sent him a picture of me, which I don't believe they did, he came straight to me and goes, "You're Billy." I went, "Yeah, I am." He said, "My security." I went, "Yeah." So we had this great conversation on the tarmac. And I think it cleared the air straight away.
Yeah.
This is what I'm here to do. This is what I can do.
Yeah.
So it was a great atmosphere of us. Then we get in the car. I said to him, "Mate, just to let you know, your cover's blown already. They know you're here." And he went into a bit of a sulk. And I says, "What's wrong?" He says, "I'm supposed to be under the radar. I really want a break. I don't want to know." I says, "Well, I'll do my best to make sure you don't get an answer, but they know you're here." So we're just pulling up at the hotel, and now there's all these people there. And I'm like, and my heart's pounding. There's me and him. And it's already out of control.
Out of control.
Yeah. And I'm just thinking, how do I control this? And a guy I'd met earlier from the paparazzi, who spoke great English, I'd said to him, you know, I'd made a deal with him, basically. So I jump out of the car, said to Tom, "Stay there." He's looking at me. I am absolutely bricking it, thinking, what am I going to do? And I shout to this guy, and he shouts something in Italian. And it was like the part of, I've never seen it before. All these people just went left and right and left us a runway all the way down to the hotel.
Fantastic.
And he looks at me, and I looked at him, and he goes, "He actually, what the hell?"
Yeah.
I just went, "SES."
That's good. And also, didn't someone come in? Didn't someone kind of...
Yeah.
Go on, who's that? Tell
so,
us about that.
So we then, anyway, so we walk down this hallway. We're just about to step into the blooming foyer of the hotel. And as we're up, we've got one foot in the door, the two of us, from the right-hand side, I just see something running. I ain't got time to turn because I've got control.
You react.
Yeah, so I reacted by grabbing hold of him, so I've got control of him, but I end up getting him around the neck.
Yeah.
And then I grab this thing running at me, a person. So I've got two heads under my arm.
Yeah.
I fall into the foyer, still stood up, but, you know, drop in the...
Yeah.
And I look, Tom, I've got Tom, and I've got this female. And then these two heads look at me, and Tom goes, "Billy, meet my girlfriend, Penelope."
So that was Penelope...
Penelope Cruz.
Penelope Cruz. That's it. You had her in a headlock.
Yeah.
That's
mate,
super.
She was not happy.
That's excellent. Such a great story.
Stories of success in the face of adversity.
Against all odds.
Against all odds.
With Mark Billy Billingham.
I'm with Billy Billingham, the most experienced and decorated leader on TV's SAS Who Dares Wins, whose military career started when he decided to join the parachute regiment age 17, which in hindsight, Billy, was probably the best decision you ever made. Is that fair?
It is, yeah. And, you know, I look back to today as the proudest moments of my life. I needed it. It was my saviour, fact.
And why three para? Just explain.
Right, so the reason I decided to join the parachute regiment after I spent 6 years in the cadets, Falklands War had just happened, come back, and I listened to everybody that used to be in the cadets with me, had gone off, been in the Falklands, came back. Unfortunately, not everybody did, but the ones that did. And I spoke to every one of them. And there's one guy there that had been shot on Mount Longdon. He'd been hit in the stomach. And he was still sort of in plaster Paris and all this. And I listened to everybody's story. And I listened to his story. And I just thought, there's something about the way he's explaining this unit that appeals to me.
You just like, I want to do that.
That's what I want to be, yeah. It's just rough and raw and ready. And I thought, that's me. And I was right. And that was my reason then to want to go to the parachute regiment and more sold to free power.
And what made you think then that you had what it takes?
I didn't know if I had what it takes. What I did know was I wasn't going to give up. it meant everything to me. I had to be there, you know. The first day of standing there and looking around, I straight away I was like, what am I doing here? What am I doing?
Because everyone's...
Yeah, everyone, you know, I was the...
A triangle shape.
Yeah, everybody was huge, you know, more mature, older. I was skinnier. And I just kind of talking myself out. But I grew in confidence as the days went by because the numbers got fewer. And then you start believing yourself, you know, and before you know it, you're right up there doing with everybody else. So, yeah.
It's interesting, obviously, your airborne infantry. Had you ever been on a plane?
Oh, my God. You know, the only planes I'd ever seen were flying over as a kid. First time I get on a plane, I'm getting thrown out of it. First time it lands, it's in a country I didn't even know existed, Belize.
So this is Belize. So you get posted to Belize, that's right,
yeah.
Isn't it?
It was the first post, just joining the battalion. The battalion had gone out there, we'd passed out. They're already out there, so I did a week of rear party in Aldershot.
Yeah.
You know, I met some of the characters of the battalion that had been there a while but leaving. That was a nice insight. And then off and literally out to Belize to join the battalion.
And what did you think? You're like, here we are, I'm going to Central America. This is going to be great.
I just heard America. So to me, I was thinking chicks, sand, beer, sunshine. And my mum goes, where in America is it? And I went, Belize. She goes, you clown, it's a jungle. If you'd have gone to school, you'd have learned geography. You know where you're going.
But you liked the jungle. You were good in the jungle, though. You liked it.
I didn't at first. It was horrific. You know, you have this, again, perception of what it should be like. I was expecting giraffes walking past, see the odd lion in the distance, a couple of, you know, it was horrendous. It was claustrophobic. It was noisy. It was uncomfortable. It was dirty. It was frightening.
Tell us about the song that reminds you of that time, of Belize and all the sort of jungle warfare training that you were up to.
Yeah, the song that reminds me of Belize and the jungle warfare stuff was Runaway by Del Shannon.
Okay, here it is, and we'll find out why after this.
As I walk along, I wonder what went wrong with our love, although it was so strong. And as I still walk on, I think of things we've done together while our hearts were young. I'm a walking in the rain, tears are falling and I feel a pain, a wishing you were here by me to end this misery. And I wonder why she ran away, and I wonder where she will stay. My little runaway, run, 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 run away.
That was Del Shannon and Runaway.
I used to find peace in listening to the radio, but there's a lad in the platoon, in the troop, Ian Endry, great friend of mine, and he was like the tough kid, and he come in from drinking late at night, and he put the radio on BFBS, and we'd all have to listen to it 2 a.m, pretend you couldn't hear it or listen to it, and I liked it.
Yeah.
And then he'd lie there drunk, and he'd go, play Del Shannon, and he's shouting at the radio, and we'd all be listening to him, chuckling in our bed, and then all of a sudden you'd hear him get up, and he's out the door, and you knew what was coming. And we'd still be listening to BFBS, and then you'd hear the door on the radio station getting kicked in. And you'd hear whoever was one of you guys going, hey, what's on my head? And he'd go, played your Shannon organ and rip your head off. And then you did, and we'd be lying in bed listening to this, chuckling.
On the radio, it's coming out of the radio.
Yeah. And then he'd hear it playing, and he'd just finished as he'd walk back in the block. So he'd be on his
he
way
missed
back.
It. Oh, that's so good.
I mean, he probably wasn't as clear as that, but that's how I remember it. It was amazing. It was brilliant, mate. And the other thing I remember at BFBS was they always had a little section where the local radio jumped into an announcement.
Yeah.
So I'd be lying in bed, like, you know, you'd be listening, what's going on in Cyprus, what's going on in London, what's going on, and it was great. You just felt in touch with the world again.
Sure.
It was awesome. And then you'd hear, okay, BFBS, this is a local radio now, and Miss Marty, can you please come home to Belmopan? Your house is on fire. Thank you.
So you were in BATSA, British Army Training Support Unit Police. So you were actually on the camp?
Yeah, I was on APC. A Company was on APC, and the rest were out at all the holding stations.
Brilliant.
Stories of success in the face of adversity, against all odds.
With Mark Billy Billingham
on BFBS, the Forces Station.
Before we talk about the SES, can I just ask you to tell the story about those pretend grenades in the pond? I read that in your book.
mate.
It's so funny.
Yeah, that was... I got posted back down to depot as an instructor, and we'd move into the new quarters. And I was cleaning out all my kit. And, you know, after every range practice, you give a declaration, you hand all that, and you just get complacent.
Yeah.
So I'm looking for my pouches, and I find a couple of Thunder Flashes. And I was like, what can I do with these? I'm too embarrassed now to go and say I've found these. So I've got an idea.
Yeah.
Because I used to love taking the kids down to the park in Aldershot, where the duck pond was.
Yeah.
And I thought, got it. I'll put a couple of batteries in it, strike them, throw them in there, it'll sink. You know, I'll get a few bubbles in the water and that'll be about it.
Yeah.
Not really thinking. So I take the kids down. I've got,
you've
these
got
two
the kids with you as well.
I didn't say anything to my missus at the time.
You didn't.
I've got my two daughters who were like 3 and 4 probably at the time or less. And we get down to the pond and it's about 5 o'clock at night. It must have been about, I don't know, January, February time because it was getting dark.
Yeah.
And I looked around and, you know, no one around. I thought, perfect timing. The kids are throwing a bit of bread in for the ducks. Oh, they're all right. I strike them, put the Thunder Flashes together, strike them, throw it into the centre of the pool. And all of a sudden, oh my God, this loud boom and a massive fountain. The kids start screaming. And what I didn't realise, it's obviously surrounded by houses.
Echoed.
Echoed. All the windows are rattling. The next thing, there's lights coming everywhere. Doors opening, windows opening, people shouting, what's going on? Thought it was an explosion.
Ducks in the air.
Ducks turned over, literally. Fish floating to the surface. I'll grab the two kids who are soaking wet and I'm running out the park with them. They're screaming. And I think to this day they've been traumatised.
So you did 8 years with 3 Para. Yeah. Then, like so many of the regiment, you decided to have a crack at getting into the SES. Why did you want to put yourself through that?
I'll tell you what it was. I didn't feel like I'd achieved everything I wanted to in the parachute regiment. I had a great time. You know, I'd gone through the ranks, got myself, you know, I was a section commander, I'd been to depot now as an instructor. I'd been on operational tours. And I just thought, where do I go next? You know, you never know what's going to happen. But what I did know was a couple of friends of mine had gone off and done selection.
Yeah.
And they didn't really say where they were and what they were doing, but I knew they were doing good stuff. You'd meet once every 6 months or whatever, and they'd just been off doing something. And I just thought, I want to be in that mysterious world. I want to see what it's all about. It sounded amazing. And I wanted to be challenged again as well, if I'm honest.
You have a mantra, always a little further. Can you just explain that?
That started when I was 9. A guy taught me about boxing, told me boxing's not a sport of brutality. It's a poor man's game of chess. And he said, anticipation, respect, da-da-da. And he says, when the chips are down, you can... And I'll never forget it. You can go always a little further. Just never give up, basically, what I'm saying. But he said those words. 20 years later, I joined the regiment. And, you know, I'm now in B Squadron. I go down to the clock tower to hear about this famous clock tower where, you know,
saying
in the regiment, you've got to beat the clock.
Yeah.
All the names are on there of people who've passed. And the collect's on there. And the collect is, you know, we are the Pilgrim's Master. And the last line underneath is, we will go always a little further. Oh. And then the hairs on the back of my neck honestly stood up. I went, oh my God. And then I just kept it to myself, you know, all the time through the regiment. And then after I left, I thought, that's, I say it to myself now. And my wife will tell you, I'll go for a run. And I've got the devil and angel in my head. And I'll say to myself, again, I'll put my trainers on, go out for a run. I'm going to do 5 kilometres, whatever. I know where the 5 kilometre point is, and I'm like, and then the little devil at 80 comes, go a little bit further. And I'll go, and I'll push it down. And now I've done 7. Then I realise, actually, I'm doing 14 because I've got to go back 7.
Yeah, always so, a little further. I love that. So what was it about proving yourself, and who are you proving this to?
I'm proving it to me. You know, I just want to say to myself, I can do it. It's all right in my head thinking I can do it and probably saying to somebody, yeah, I can do that. I'm one of those, I'll go and do it. Then I'll talk about it.
Yeah.
I wanted to know if I was good enough, and I wanted to see what that world was all about. Yeah. And that was my reasons for going.
When you went for selection, how many people turned up on that first day?
183, I think it was.
Yeah.
And again, it was like going back to day one, standing on a square of 183 people, and everybody looked bigger, everybody looked better.
Yeah.
You know, we all do that. And
how do you deal with that then? How do you deal with that?
I just say to myself, well, I ain't going out that gate unless they throw me out the gate. I'm not throwing my hand in. Mm. You know, I either totally mess it up and fail, or they say I'm not good enough.
How many passed?
7.
Out of 183?
3, yeah. There was 3 officers as well, but I don't count the officers. I only count the blokes.
Yeah, yeah.
Because, you know, we're on a different sort of regime to them.
And everyone knows when you pass and fail, don't they? Because you've got to come back, haven't you? Everyone knows you're off, aren't you? That must be tough.
It's a big ballsy thing to do, because, you know, you're leaving, you get a little bit more time than everybody else to train generally. I was lucky because I was in the depot, so I was training anyway, I was fit. And I thought it was all about the fitness. I was totally wrong, of course. But, you know, so, and then in your mind, you don't want to let yourself down. And you don't want to let the unit down, and you certainly don't want to go walking back after 2 or 3 days and go, you know, I failed. Because you know everybody's judging you, and they do. The blokes will ridicule you. However, you know, deep down, everybody's pleased for you to at least go and have a go. And there is a massive element of luck, to be honest.
You just can't get an injury, can you?
No. You get an injury or one bad mistake, you know, you've took one navigational error, and it's easy done.
Yeah. Can you remember when you first thought, you know what, I'm actually quite good at this. I'm in the right place, you know?
It felt right, yeah. I never says I'm good at this. I always felt I should be here.
Let's play another song. So tell us about the toughest moment of selection for you.
The toughest time for me on selection was on the Ills, when I had a bit of an incident. Got a little bit complacent, if I'm honest. A little bit lazy, I would say. And it was on the Elan Valley. It was on test week. About to do one of the 27K or 28K marches, you know, in a very fast time, as it should be. And I set off, and it was pea soup. I couldn't see more than 6 inches in front of my face. Literally stood face to face, breathing on each other when I got the grid off the DS. And I knew there was a river, or a small stream, as it was, in front of me. Couldn't see it. It was only 20 metres away. And I should have gone to the right for about 600 metres, crossed the bridge, come back to exact point, and then navigated on. And I thought, no, I'm going to go direct. So that's what I decided to do. So I'll leave, got my grid, off I've gone, and I've gone 20 metres, I'm in the stream, which is, I remember it in the summer being a stream. It's now a raging torrent. It's waist deep, I'm halfway across this river, and slimy underneath, I slipped, and I've got like £80 on my back.
On your Bergen?
Yeah, so I'm drowning. I'm leaning forward, the Bergen's pushing my head under, the water's rushing down, it's freezing cold. And in order to survive, I've got to try and stand up. So I had to push off the bottom. I let go of my weapon to push up. And as I stand up, got my breath, I was like panicking a little bit. I calmed myself down, leant back down to grab my weapon. Gone. And I was like, oh my God, I've got to go back to that vehicle and tell them I've lost my weapon.
You're out, aren't you?
I might as well be at the army. I don't want to be in the army if I've lost my weapon.
Yeah.
So long story short, I end up in that water for about 30 odd minutes, probably longer. Working my way down, trying to work out the way the current's going. And I end up about 10 metres to the left, downstream of where I started. And by the grace of God, I found the weapon. I don't know how to this day. I found it. I got out that water, and that was the fastest time I did on selection that day. I sprinted. I never stopped sprinting from every checkpoint and never went through that same mistake again. And the thing that kept me going was a song by Matthew Wilder. Ain't never gonna break my stride. I just kept saying it and saying it. And in the distance, if I could see anybody, I was saying to myself, I'm never gonna break my stride. Nobody's gonna slow me down. And I use that person as the target to get past.
millions know you as the chief instructor on the hit TV show SES Who Dares Wins. What's your favourite bit about filming the show?
The favourite bit for me is the mirror rooms.
I love the mirror rooms.
Yeah, well, I didn't. Initially, I hated it. I didn't really... The first time I went on there, I wasn't really sure how this was going to go and what I was really going to be doing or what wanted to do. I was very aware there was a camera in my face.
Yeah.
I was very guarded about what I thought I should and shouldn't say. Now, I'm just totally relaxed with it. We run it as a course. We don't see it as a show. We run the course. There's cameras everywhere. It doesn't bother us at all. And you're mic'd up 24 hours a day. But for me, it didn't take that long to work it out. I didn't like the mirror rooms because I was a bit aggressive in it and I was not sure where I was going. Now I love it.
I'm always amazed by how much they open up.
Yeah.
Aren't you? I feel like sometimes, you know, when the celebrities talk about something, or whoever the contestants are when they talk about something, it's like they've never talked about that before, but they are to you. Why do you think they
That's their reason they've come. They just want to get this world... Because they don't know who they are. Every single person that comes on that show have come for one reason, to find out who they are. And the only way you can find out who you truly are is when you... Open, peel yourself back to your most vulnerable state. Let go of all what you think that's bothering you, what's worrying you. Then you've got nothing else to worry about. Mm. And that's why they do it. Now, just so you know, we don't know who they are till day one. You might get a whisper because it's in the press,
yeah.
You know, especially the celebrity ones, but we don't know who they are. And to be honest, most of them I don't know who they are anyway.
No.
And that in the mirror room. So I kind of got the logic, right, find out, tell me about your backstory, tell me about your growing up. What don't you like? Have you been in trouble with the law? There's only three ways you can go with this.
Yeah.
And then someone will come out. They've waited that moment to come out with it.
I'm amazed by that, yeah. Aren't you? It must hit you in the face when they do.
It does hit us in the face. We're not psychologists. We're not experts. You know,
you're very good at doing it. You're all very good at doing it.
Because, hey, you've got to look at the lifestyles we've had. We've been in dark places. And the bottom line is, no matter what it is, it's a dark space.
Yeah.
You're in a mental... painful place in your life, and they really want to say is, how do you get out of it? And we've done that a lot of times and got out of it, and you see them honestly once they've spoke about it, it's off the weight's off their shoulders. They walk out that mirror room 5 inches taller. And the beauty of that is, what I really love is, if we have our phones with us that night, it goes mental,
really,
or when it goes out on the show, and you have thousands of people messaging going, thanks, if so and so, my hero, can talk about being abused, going through an art talk, then I can do it. And that's the beauty of the show, and that's what I love about it. And people don't know a lot about that, but it's amazing to know how many people you've really helped.
Stories of success in the face of adversity.
Against all odds.
Against all odds.
I'm with SAS legend Billy Billingham MBE, talking about some of the key moments in his life and the records that soundtrack the memories. So you joined the SAS in 91 as a mountain troop specialist. What is a mountain troop specialist?
So basically, the regiment has four squadrons. In each squadron, there are four troops, and each troop specialises in every method of getting into a target or right. getting out of a target. You know, in war, conflict, and in, you know, times of natural disaster. So, if we're going over mountains, a mountain troop specialises in that. Everything from above the snow line, below the snow line, climbing, skiing. And yeah, moving through sort of arduous terrain, navigating and all that sort of stuff. So that was my role.
I'm interested in, so you've passed selection now, and what's it like? You walk into the SES barracks for the first time. What's that like?
I tell you, it's true, right? Now, I go through selection. I kind of had that thought in my head anyway. These are going to be huge, super fit dudes.
Yeah.
I knew a couple of people who'd obviously been in there, and they were pretty fit and, you know, good-looking dudes and all that stuff. So I finished training, finished selection, and I'm going to B Squadron Mountain Troop. So I've got the image of B Squadron. And B Squadron were the ones when everybody first heard about the regiment, you know, it was the 1980 Iranian embassy. That was B Squadron. Obviously, I wasn't there, but that was our boys.
Yeah.
And that's what I remember. So I've got this image of what I'm expecting, these sort of Chippendale fit dudes. And I go walking round to what they call the interest room. The interest room is where all the guys hang out. Like, you know, each squadron's got an interest room.
Yeah.
And you do all your planning there. You do all that sort of stuff. All your histories on the walls. So I walk to B Squadron interest room. The door's open. There's a bunch of blokes all sat around a table. There's a guy at a tier, a rather large bloke, I will say. I can say fat, I think.
You can say,
He's massive. And he's making a brew. And I walk in there, and I'm kind of shocked. And he's seen I'm shocked, and he looks at me, I'm looking at everybody else. And they're like, and the guy goes to me, he goes, "You're right, son." I went, "Yeah, I'm all right, mate." He goes, "Welcome to Beach Squad." And he goes, "You want to go for a run?" I looked at him, I went, "I can run, mate. Yeah, I'll go for a run with you, big boy." So we do. We go out the gate, turn left, and I saw the sole of his shoe for 30 metres. I never seen him again.
Because you're so quick.
And I was like, what the hell is this? By the time I get back to the interest room, he's had a shower, he's got changed, and I'm like, and then the penny dropped. It's not about an image. This is about what is between their ears, you know? And yeah. I thought, wow. And then the next one, we're planning an operation, and I'm watching. It was like a jigsaw being put together, you know, political situation. And I'm like, what is this world?
Right, we need another song. Tell us about the next song and why it's important, and where in the world does this story start?
So this song, that reminds me of my time in the regiment, and one of the happiest but saddest was a song called Hotel California. And in the early days of the Bosnian War, I find myself in Bosnia, me and a good comrade, friend of mine, and we had an interpreter with us, a female interpreter, absolute legend of a girl, ballsy as hell. You know, we were really in a weird space at this stage. We didn't really have a proper role, so we were in no man's land, danger land all the time. We were a target to everybody. And I remember one day, we ended up finding our way through this minefield. So we're actually in a minefield, and we're finding out where the front line is, and we found it. We're overlooking this river onto a village, and it looks like a Hollywood film set. It doesn't look real. And there's an attack going into this village. Basically, there's a cleansing thing going on, and we're literally watching it. Now, the interpreter didn't say a great deal about it. We've got the binos, and we're logging, reporting what we can see and all this sort of stuff. And she had a little transistor radio, and she used to say to us, "Is it okay if I play my music?" It wasn't a problem because there's bombs and bullets going off everywhere. No one's going to hear this radio. Yeah. We're hiding anyway. So we're lying there, me and my friend, with the binos looking and going, "Oh my God, look at that. You know, there's people hanging out of cars, dying. There's houses on fire. They're fighting through the village. It's like a fibula attack." And we're watching it. It's just surreal. And I can hear Hotel California in the background. And then I can hear sniveling, crying. So I nudged my mate and I went, "So-and-so's crying." He went, "Oh." Looks back. And then I look back and I went, "Hey." I can say it now. I said, "Hey, Kamala." I says, "Listen, if that song's upsetting you," because I'm thinking she's worrying about her boyfriend. I said, "If that song's upsetting you, don't play it. You can turn it off." And she just looked at me and says, "No, Billy, that's my house down there. That's my family." And I just wanted to roll over onto a mine. I just thought, what have I just said? And, you know, my buddy just looked at me and went, "Oh, my God." But she just carried on and off. She was amazing. Yeah, it was just that unbelievable moment watching this, and that was her house. Or one, you know, within that village that was on fire. I mean, I have to say, and I'm lucky to say this, a family did survive. And when I left Bosnia, she was really sweet. She gave me the flag of the Muslim army. It said, "Billy, Bosnia loves you. I love you. Hotel California." And I've still got it.
I'm with SAS legend and TV star Billy Billingham, MBE, and this is Against All Odds, stories of success in the face of adversity. So you served 20 years in the SAS, which took you to all the major hotspots in the world. Can we talk about Baghdad and the Gulf War? Because you were there in 2003. I know that being an SAS operator means that you have to be careful talking about past operations you've been involved in. Can you tell us anything about your mission in the Gulf War?
Yeah, I mean, after the initial part, you know, the ground war, as you like, was, it's out there for everybody to see. We're there to stop the tyrant and also to find these weapons of mass destruction and all the other stuff that was going on there. So that was the first part of it. And then when we pulled out, we were then over there to, you know, stop the sort of insurgents building up the ISIS as it was at the time, stopping all that sort of stuff and trying create a safe haven so that they could rebuild their country. And we all know how that went, you know. Mm. So you end up then doing small missions, small raids to take out the wanted people, the now, you know, insurgent suicide bombers and all that sort of stuff, that sort of stuff. So that was the stuff that was really going on night after night. It was, you know, a tough old time for being out there.
Tell us about the song we're about to hear. This reminds you of the Gulf War, doesn't it? So tell us why you picked it.
Without getting all weird about it, you know, everybody has a little ritual. You know, if you generally didn't get time to phone home, or you weren't allowed to phone home anyway. So you have your own little way of processing before you go out that night, because the truth is, you generally don't know if you're going to come back. And I always found that every sort of mission we went out, which was really every night, as soon as we heard the word, this might be a quiet one tonight, you knew it weren't going to be a quiet one. So I used to get ready, and being the sergeant major, I'd give the last set of the orders, the last bit of the orders, you know, to tie it all together before we went out and did any jobs. And I shared a room. I had the storeman. I shared the room with him because he was tight living at the time. And I'd just throw him out about an hour before. I'd get all my stuff ready, you know, look at my little photographs of the family, put all that away, put everything together, get all your stuff together. And then I'd just get myself in the mood. I'd then go, right, park my family life. Done. Seen all that, done that now, that's done. Should it all go wrong, somebody can come in here and take that and pass that on, whatever you need to do. And then I'd play Guns N' Roses, Sweet Child of Mine. And it just finished, I was putting my body armor onto war, and I'd be like, yes, I'm ready. And then just walk straight into the officer, into the briefing room and give that bit. And that's that, done there. Family's parked, everything's parked, we're all focused. And it really is a selfish life, but yeah, that was the one thing. Every single night I'd play Guns N' Roses, Sweet Child of Mine. Just fired me up inside to go and get on with it.
Where do we go now?
That was Guns N' Roses and Sweet Child of Mine.
Against All Odds with Mark Billy Billingham.
You must have lost lots of friends and colleagues along the way. How do you manage and process that loss?
You know, without getting morbid and all that sort of stuff, I know for a fact every single person that we've lost in these conflicts and these missions and stuff that we've done, not always in war, we've lost a lot in training as well. I know for a fact, if you stood that person next to you now and said, look, you go on this mission, there's a chance, they'd still be there. They'd go again. We really believed in what we were doing. Not to go, oh, well, you know, we're some sacrificial lunatics. We're not. You always believed in the greater good. We always believe we're doing it for the right reasons and we need to be there. So so when somebody gets killed, it again, it's surreal, because 2 minutes before I was having a laugh and a joke with this person, or you know, you've got your last little bit of fun and you never expect it's going to happen or going to happen to you anyway. And then when it really hits home is, I remember standing at the grave of, you know, quite a few friends and stuff, and we have a great ritual the regiment did where the coffin goes down. The wife and the children, if they are, or the family members, are stood at the side of the grave, and then the C-130 had come over the top of the grave with two Chinooks with the lights on, and just spread, and it was like the angel coming down to take you away. That was the moment I'd always say to myself, are we doing the right thing? Is this worth it? And then for that moment, you question yourself for a bit. You know, it's really rips your heart out. You just think, that's another real great person we just put in the ground for what? And then you just, you know, think about it a bit later on. Yeah, I believe it was worth it, and we'll go on. And it's a song called Angel Flight. It's by Rodney Foster. And I'll just get a cigar, have a drink, and just listen to this song for a little bit, and then pick myself up again.
All I ever wanted to do was fly, leave this world and live in the sky. I left the C-130 out of Fort Worth town. I go up someday.
This is BFBS Radio. You're listening to Against All Odds, Stories of Success in the Face of Adversity, with me, Richard Hatch. And my special guest has been SES legend and decorated war hero, Billy Billingham, MBE. The last song we're going to play is your wedding song, which will play soon, but just tell us about your partner and how you met her.
Yeah, my wife Jules, she's American. She's the world's biggest tree hugger, I call her. So it's funny how we met, because at the time I'd left the regiment and I'd just finished bodyguarding full time. We had a little business, security business, out in Iraq, and I was out in Iraq and there was a news flash, and long story short, about 2010 there was an earthquake in a place called Haiti. So I remember watching it because it was a news flash. You know, especially military, you watch it, what's this all about? And what got me was the earthquake had only just happened and there's 100,000 people dead. And I went, nah, that's not right. So that number stuck in my head. And anyway, before I went to bed, by the third time the news flash update came on, there was 250,000 people dead and missing. I thought, being the military men that we are and the military people that we are, we're very charitable people because we've seen suffering. You know, we've got everything's about hearts and minds.
Yeah.
So that night I couldn't sleep, and we owned the business and we'd done a lot of charity stuff out, you know, in Iraq at the time and everywhere else. And I end up bumping to my middle of the night, can't sleep, get up, have a cup of coffee, and there's my business partner. And he goes, you're thinking about Haiti, aren't you? And I went, yeah. I said, let's do something. Long story short, so I end up going out to Haiti, see what the real situation was on the ground, and with a vision of sending over 47 flat pack units to build an hospital. That was the plan.
Yeah.
So I get out there and I meet this total tree hugger, lovely looking woman, totally out of my league. But I was, you know, thinking I was in the league. Of course I wasn't. So I get talking to her and it just went from there. I just loved her passion, loved what she did. She's a disaster relief worker. And we end up forming a charity called Rebuild Globally, which is putting kids into school and then into job training. And then to total way to end poverty, obviously you've got to give them a job. So then she set up Give Them a Job. So that's what we ended up doing. But everybody used to look at us walking around going, they're the most oddest couple in the world. And they used to say, he kills them and she buries them.
So
that's how I met her.
That's really good. Would it be fair to say you're the happiest and most content in your life?
Absolutely, because I know what's important in life. it does take that, you know, that journey to really understand, as we all know. And as you get to this age, you realise the nonsense and the noise that's not even worth bothering about, that we do all spend most of our time getting involved in. That's what causes you the not to sleep at night, and the stress and all that worry. You know, who cares about materials? Who cares about money? Who cares about how many people like you? Just tell the truth anyway. If you want to say something, we're in this world where people keep saying, I can't say that. Well, you can say it, as long as you're not being vindictive, you're not being nasty, and you believe in it. Now, I'm not expecting everybody to go, well, he's right. What I'm saying is, this is my point of view. This is my view. Please respect it. I'll respect yours.
Yeah.
I'm at that point in my life now where what's important to me is my health and time. We don't know how much we've got left. My family and my friends.
Where would you be without the army?
I wouldn't be sat here, that's for sure. I know I wouldn't. I'd probably be dead. Truth, I'd be dead. At best, I'd be in jail.
Okay, always a little further, Billy. What's next for you?
I'm going to continue with the TV stuff because I enjoy it. I've been trying to get back into freefall. I'm just about to re-qualify. And then I wanted to try and break a world record parachute, but she won't let me.
Okay, so tell us about your wedding song.
So my wedding song is Thinking Out Loud by Ed Sheeran. And the reason I love this is because, and when everybody sees our wedding video, I've got two left feet. However, she makes me look great. I just stand there and she spins all around me. But that is our song, yeah. Thinking Out Loud by Ed Sheeran.
Billy Billingham, MBE, thanks so much for coming on Against All Odds.
It's a pleasure, mate, honestly. It really is. And BFBS, it's our community. It's our family.
When your legs don't work like they used to before, and I can't sweep you off of your feet, will your mouth still remember the taste of my love? Will your eyes still smile from your cheeks? Darling, I will be loving you till we're 70. And baby, my heart could still fall less hard at 23. And I'm thinking about how people fall in love in mysterious ways. Maybe just the touch of a hand. Well, me, I fall. Honey, now take me into your loving arms. Kiss me under the light of a thousand stars. Place your head on my beating heart. I'm thinking now. My hair's all but gone and my memory fades, and the crowds don't remember my name. When my hands don't play the strings the same way, I know you will still love me the same. 'Cause honey, your soul could never grow. Baby, your smile's forever in my mind and memory. I'm thinking about how people fall in love in mysterious ways. And maybe it's all part of a plan. Well, I'll just keep on making the
Plus throughout the UK. This is BFBS. The Forces Station.